Dr. Henk Bos of the University of Utrecht is here to talk about the Leibnizian tradition. But before introducing Henk, I'd like you to listen to some words written by Leibniz himself about the process of discovery in mathematics.
It is an extremely useful thing to have knowledge of the true origins of memorable discoveries, especially those that have been found not by accident, but by dint of meditation. It is not so much that thereby history may attribute to each man his own discoveries, and that others should be encouraged to earn like commendation, as that the art of making discoveries should be extended by considering noteworthy examples of it.
The particular example that Dr. Bos is going to talk about here is, of course, the calculus.
I do find these sentences of Leibniz very illuminating. The art of making discoveries. This was a key idea with Leibniz. So, with this idea in mind, I'm going to pick up some aspects of the history of the Leibnizian tradition in the infinitesimal calculus. The details are in the units. Let's start with Leibniz's invention of his calculus in 1675. There is a section on that in unit C3 called Glimpses of a Process of Discovery. We can follow that process quite closely because the manuscripts are still in existence. So, this invention forms an extremely good example of how the history of mathematics can be used for understanding the process of invention. Leibniz started with three key ideas: a great interest in notation and symbols, then the insight that finding quadratures and tangents are similar processes to taking sums and differences, and are therefore inversely related. And, last, insight in the use of the so-called characteristic triangle. We can follow in the manuscripts how these ideas guided his research. We can see Leibniz experimenting with a new notation for Cavalieri's use of indivisibles, working in the sums and difference ideas, introducing the integral symbol, actually a long script S, for summation, and the D for differentiation, and exploring the rules which these symbols should obey in order to be useful tools in the study of quadratures and tangents. I won't go into the successive steps of Leibniz's discovery here, but I would like to state explicitly why I think that this particular set of manuscripts of Leibniz is so invaluable for the history of mathematics. They contain more than merely the attempts to solve a common mathematical problem, such as calculating this or that area, or determining such or such a curve. No, they contain the process of creating a method, creating, really, a separate art of making discoveries. And it proved to be a most effective method, the method of the Leibnizian differential and integral calculus. What, then, were the basic elements in the Leibnizian tradition of the differential and integral calculus? There were three. First, the concepts of the infinitely small differential and the integral as a sum of differentials. Then, the inverse relation of differentiation and integration. And last, the D and integral symbols, and, more important than the symbols themselves, the conviction that questions about tangents, quadratures, and inverse tangent problems should be reduced to operations with formulae, differentiation, integration, and solving differential equations. Now, I'll turn to the 18th century. There are two important aspects of the Leibnizian tradition in the 18th century. First, the elaboration of its methods and its growth in scope. And second, the changing ideas about its fundamental concept, the differential. On the first aspect, you'll find a lot in Unit C5, which presents the calculus at work. It shows the standard techniques of the calculus in the 18th century and examples of problems solved by those techniques. On the second aspect, you will find most of the material in Unit C4, and I'd now like to mention the main themes of that unit. We can start with the year 1784, exactly 100 years after the first publication of the calculus. In that year, Lagrange was director of the Royal Academy of Sciences, Arts and Literature in Berlin. The Academy, as was common in those days, used to set prize contests on scientific subjects. So Lagrange himself proposed a contest on the question of the infinite and the infinitely small in mathematics. Here's how the announcement of the contest was worded.
The utility derived from mathematics, the esteem it is held in, and the honorable name of exact science par excellence, justly given it, are all the due of the clarity of its principles, the rigor of its proofs, and the precision of its theorems. In order to ensure the perpetuation of these valuable advantages in this elegant part of knowledge, there is needed a clear and precise theory of what is called infinite in mathematics. The Academy, therefore, desires an explanation of how it is that so many correct theorems have been deduced from a contradictory supposition, together with an enunciation of a sure, a clear, in short, a true mathematical principle that may be properly substituted for that of the infinite, without, however, rendering investigations carried out by its means overly difficult or overly lengthy.
Apparently, something was felt to be wrong with the infinitesimal calculus. What exactly was wrong? We can read this from the introduction to one of the essays which was entered for the competition. In fact, this one did not get the prize, but when its author, Lazare Carnot, published it some years later, it became very popular. It's called On the Metaphysics of the Infinitesimal Calculus, and it starts like this.
There is no discovery which has produced in the mathematical sciences such a fortunate and swift revolution as that of infinitesimal analysis. No discovery has provided more simple and more effective methods to penetrate the knowledge of the laws of nature. By decomposing, so to speak, the bodies into their ultimate elements, analysis seems to have indicated their inner structure and organization. But because all which is ultimate escapes the senses and the imagination, one has never been able to form more than an imperfect idea of these elements. Singular kinds of beings, which now sometimes play the role of real quantities, and then again have to be treated as absolute zeros, and which seem, by their equivocal properties, to stand halfway between quantity and zero, between existence and nothingness.
Entities which stay halfway between being and non-being. Here Carnot has the infinitely small differentials in mind, and what was wrong with them was exactly that they were neither nothing nor something. For what did infinitely small mean? In practice, it meant that you could, in certain cases, discard infinitely small quantities, that is, treat them as if they were equal to zero. But in other cases, you could calculate their ratio, that is, deal with them as if they were unequal to zero. So, infinitely small differentials are self-contradictory, not to say nonsensical. But they work. If we follow the rules of discarding them, we get correct results. You will find many examples of this in Unit C5, where we see the calculus at work, and successfully enough. So, there was a problem in the foundations of the calculus, which was strongly felt in the 18th century. you'll remember that Bishop George Berkeley had used the contradictions involved in the concept of differentials in a very sharp attack on the calculus in 1734. Now, I'd like to mention the main points in the 18th century discussions on the foundations of the calculus, to give you a sort of guideline through the relevant sections of Unit C4. The first answer to the criticism of infinitely small entities was this. The calculus, in fact, does not deal with differentials themselves, but only with the ratio. If you determine a tangent, you don't calculate dy and dx themselves, but only their ratio, which gives you the ratio of ordinate and subtangent. So, one argued, it does not matter that the differentials are infinitely small, because their ratio is finite. Euler, for instance, in 1755, claimed that all differentials are in fact equal to zero, but have finite ratios. Now, of course, this is not an argument, but a smokescreen. If differentials are self-contradictory, or even may not exist, then also their ratio is self-contradictory or non-existent. So there's still a foundational problem left. In Newton's fluxional calculus, the foundational problems started at this stage. Newton used the ultimate ratios of evanescent quantities as the fundamental concept. But the evanescent quantities were considered at the very moment when they vanish. And this is a state between being and non-being, exactly similar to the case of differentials. So, the same objections applied to Newton's ultimate ratios. You can't answer the question by merely saying that we study the ratio of differentials and not the differentials themselves. This does not work. There must be an alternative way to introduce this ratio. The alternative was found in the concept of limit. The concept was worked out for Newton's calculus by Benjamin Robbins in answer to Berkeley's criticism, and D'Alembert did the same for the Leibnizian calculus. Their argument ran like this. What we are interested in is not the ratio of differentials, but the limit to which the ratio of the corresponding finite differences approaches when these differences are taken ever smaller. We call this limit the differential quotient. But what is a limit? A limit of a variable quantity, say Robbins and D'Alembert, is the value to which this variable quantity can approach as near as one wishes. Now, the first thing to appreciate in this argument is that it really solves a problem. It's no smokescreen and no play on words. By using the limit concept, the differential quotient is no longer defined directly as a quotient of differentials, but indirectly as a number which has a certain property. This property is that the ratio of finite differences can approach it as near as we wish. So, by using the limit concept, we can avoid the question whether or not the differential quotient is really a quotient of differentials. We need no longer answer the question whether infinitely small differentials really exist. The second point to appreciate is that this use of the concept of limit throws up new problems. How, for instance, can one be sure that such a limit exists? This leads to questions of differentiability and continuity. There's a short section in Unit C4 on that, but in fact, the problem was only cleared up in the 19th century. Well, I've devoted quite some time in this program to the development of the foundations of the calculus, but of course the 18th century mathematicians did more than ponder on the foundations. They applied it, with great success. Why did the calculus prove so successful? There is one sentence in the passage from Carnot which sums up the reason quite nicely.
By decomposing, so to speak, the bodies into their ultimate elements, analysis seems to have indicated their inner structure and organization.
Now, this in fact is a very apt description of the power of the calculus to deal with physical problems. For example, think about the motion of a body sliding down along a curve. It slides down under the influence of the force of gravity. But it's influenced by other forces too, friction and air resistance. All of these influences are variable. Where the path is nearly horizontal, gravity will not cause a great acceleration, but friction will be greater. Where the path is more inclined, there will be less friction and more acceleration. Moreover, friction and air resistance depend on the velocity. If the velocity is greater, there's more friction and resistance. So, with all the forces acting on the body varying, how can we calculate their effect? How can we determine what the motion of the body will be? Well, we can do it if we divide the process of motion up into its ultimate elements. That is, if we consider an infinitely small interval of time during which the body moves over an infinitely small portion of the curve. Over this interval of time, you may say that the forces acting remain constant, so that you can work out a relation between the forces and the motion they produce. This relation is one between infinitesimals. If you express it as an equation, you get an equation between differentials, that is, a differential equation. And with luck, you can integrate the equation, and so you can find what will happen. Put like this, of course, it sounds much easier than it actually is. But nevertheless, a vast field of applications was opened up by the calculus. So, the Leibnizian calculus proved a momentous tool for science. Leibniz was more right than he could have imagined when, in the manuscripts of 1675, just after the introduction of the integral sign, he interjected the following sentence.
These are sufficiently new and notable since they will lead to a new calculus.
Now, with me in the studio are the two authors of the calculus units, Margaret Barron, who specialized in the earlier history of the calculus, and Henk Bos of the University of Utrecht, who specialized in its later history. And I'm going to ask them first why they think that the history of the calculus is a particularly important aspect of the evolution of mathematics. Henk.
Well, I would say because calculus is pretty well the most important part of mathematics. Now, perhaps that's overcharged. But calculus was historically the beginning of analysis, and still now, calculus, I mean elementary differentiation and integration, forms the introduction to analysis. Grossly, you may reckon, to belong to analysis, every part of mathematics which concerns functions and limits. And that's quite a large part of mathematics. And I think, therefore, that the history of the calculus is important. I could give another reason, too, which is perhaps related. Historically speaking, calculus was the first branch of mathematics to reach a state of being very sophisticated and sufficiently broad and widely applicable outside mathematics. Obviously, there had been sophisticated parts of mathematics before. Take Eudoxus' theory of proportion. Also, there had been parts of mathematics which were applicable. Take counting techniques, or calculating techniques, that kind of thing. But I think that the combination of wide applicability and a degree of sophistication, that was what calculus reached for the first time, and that made its history very important. The third unit on Newton and Leibniz explains more about this unifying process of the various methods which had been worked out before. And one of the unifying ideas has been mentioned. It was the fundamental theorem. The other was the use of algorithms, symbolism and notation, so that you can translate a problem into formulas and solve the problem by calculating, manipulating with formulas. After this stage, there follows the stage in the history of the calculus of consolidation and extension. And this phase is described in the last two units on the calculus in the 18th century. The calculus grew and was applied. At the same time, it grew, as it were, at its roots. That is, there was a lot of discussion about the foundations of the calculus. There were still grave doubts about the new methods. They could not be rigorously proved, but obviously they were very powerful. So the question was, why did they work? And this question caused a fundamental change of character in the calculus, which you may describe as a move away from geometry and a move towards what we now call analysis, and what for that time can be most aptly described as more manipulation with formulas. And this move away is illustrated most clearly by the change of the most important concept, which changed from the curve, the tangent, and the quadrature to the function, the derivative, and the integral, and these concepts linked by the most fundamental concept of limit.
Well, now, Henk, you said earlier how important calculus was as a part of mathematics. But when we look at the development of the calculus, would you say that it developed in a way that was typical of the kind of way that most of mathematics has evolved?
Well, globally, I'd say no. You could say that the development of the calculus is typical for the development of mathematical theories. But mathematics is more than theories alone. Take, for instance, techniques. Take techniques like calculating with the abacus, or techniques like using a computer. I am quite sure that if you would follow the pattern of development of these techniques, you would find different patterns than you find in following the development of the calculus. Yes, I would single out two points, the question of rigor and the question of method. As to rigor, Greek mathematics was very rigorous. That is, proofs had to be proofs and not just arguments to make things plausible. In fact, the very idea of proof is a Greek idea. In later development of the calculus, we will see that this rigor had to be loosened a bit. So we will see a certain tension between rigor on the one hand and looseness but daring methods on the other hand. As to the other idea, the idea of method, it is essential to see that as to calculus methods, in Greek times, there was not a unified theory, but separate particular methods had for each problem to be modified, to be applied. The problem with these primary source material is their style, and that the students are not used to this style. It is a style which requires a much slower tempo of reading and studying than the students are used to, because they should have in mind that every sentence has to be seen as a conclusion from the preceding sentence. So my advice would be, read very slowly and think after each sentence whether you can see how that follows from the previous sentence.
If you were asked to summarize this first calculus unit as briefly as you can and using non-technical language, What would you say, Hink?
Well, this is indeed an impossible question, but I'd say, give a try in this way. Calculus with the Greeks concerned determination of areas. Now, how do you measure areas? You measure them with squares. Square feet, square inch, square millimeters, etc. But always squares. It is a very square procedure. Now, how about an area which is bounded by a curved line, such as a circle or a part of a parabola? You can draw a square in such an area, but it will not fill it. And then you can draw squares in the remainder of the area, but you'll never fill the whole area with squares. Unless, of course, you go on till infinity. But what does that mean? Well, that is what Unit 1 is about. Going on till infinity. But trying to say what happens before you actually reach infinity, because, of course, you can't go on till infinity. We call that limit processes, or infinitesimal arguments. And they form the central issue of the calculus. And in Unit 1, we study this in the case of Greek mathematics. And one of the nice things of these primary source material is that from these materials, the students can learn another very important thing, namely that mathematical concepts do change, that they have a history. Now take, for instance, the concept of integral. Through the units, you can see that that concept can be found in antiquity in the determination of areas. And then later, in the 17th century, it changes to a method of determination of areas under curves in general. Then there occurs another change in the 18th century, namely that integration is viewed as an operation on formulas. Then it is seen as the inverse of differentiation, and that again is changed at the end of the 18th century, the beginning of the 19th century, where the older concept of summation is taken up again. So from this one theme, the students can see that that which we now call integration is the outcome of a very complicated process of change of concepts, change from the simple to the more general, and also going back and forth between two kinds of approaches, summation and viewing integration as the inverse of differentiation.
Of course, these early ideas, Henk, are highly geometric, aren't they?
Yes, I'd like to pick that one up. Because, of course, when one looks at the calculus as it is taught now, it's not so much about geometry, it's about functions. Possibly there are some graphs in it, but it's mainly about functions and manipulation with formulas. So that's one of the things we have in the history of the calculus, a changeover of style. From a geometrical style to what I'd like to call an analytical style. Geometrical, that means working with figures and being primarily interested in geometrical things, such as curves, tangent, curvature, meet of curves, areas under curves, etc. The analytical style is different. You are no longer interested in figures, but in formulae. In manipulation with formulae, and especially for the calculus, this is differentiation and integration. So here we have a change of style, a very interesting one, which starts with Descartes and Viète introducing the analytical geometry. I'd like to add one point, namely that there has been a tension between these styles, the geometrical and the analytical style, which is quite clearly seen in unit C5, where the catenary problem is treated, and where you see this difficulty of changeover, Bernoulli's solution, which is talked about there, is not quite geometrical, it is very analytical, but is still hampered by remains of the geometrical approach.
Can I just pick up a point that you said a moment ago? You mentioned the question of notation. Now, there was, of course, a general algebraic notation which was developing and which, of course, played a role in the history of the calculus. But what about the specialized notation that was invented just for the calculus itself? How important a part did this play in the history?
Well, of course, it was an important point, although I personally would say that the conviction to translate into notation anyway is more important than the special notation which you choose. But the students will find, at the end of Unit 3, a comparison between the notation which Newton introduced and the notation which Leibniz introduced, and arguments about which of the two was better and which drawbacks, in this case, the Newtonian notation had. I'd like to add another point on notation, which becomes clear in Unit C5, where several problems of the early calculus are treated, and where we use primary source material, in which, of course, the Leibnizian D and integral notation is used. And in some cases, we have translated this in the notation which the students are used to from the general mathematics course units. And this makes for them possible to compare the notation as it was in the early calculus in the Leibnizian tradition and the notation which is used now, in which the D has been abolished and in which we use derivative functions rather than differentials. And I personally find it very fascinating there to see how, on the one hand, the D and integral notation is, in cases, easier, it leads you easier to your solution. On the other hand, it is less rigorous. And the Open University notation is better because it keeps to the rigor of the mathematical argument.
But of course, the rigor did appear again later, didn't it, Henk?
Yes, it did. And this story is told in Unit C4, and the students will have heard a bit about it in the fourth radio program. They will have heard that the key concept in providing a more rigorous base for the calculus was the limit concept. But they will also have seen that in the 18th century, the debate on the foundations was a separate issue from the general development of the calculus. So a reasonable question to ask there is, was this debate on the foundations in the 18th century more than a pastime for logical quibblers? Was it really important in that time? And the answer is that for the development of analysis as a technique, as a tool for study of problems, it was not important in the 18th century. Its importance came only in the 19th century, where it helped to clear up very difficult problems, for instance about convergence or about the existence of solutions of differential equations. But for the 18th century, it's important to stress that the really great development of the calculus lay in its applications rather than in the foundations. Yes, the role of application, I think that's a very important point, but I'd like to make precise, it was application and inspiration from outside of mathematics. And I'd like to refer here to Unit C5, which deals with the standard techniques of the calculus in the 18th century and with problems solved by means of these techniques in the 18th century. Now, it's interesting to see where these problems came from. They came from the direct surrounding of the mathematicians. For instance, a question of what is the form of a free-hanging rope, which you can see everywhere about you. They came from more organized fields like mechanics or astronomy or optics, and the problems came also from practice. And I'd like to mention one example here, namely the practice of navigation. Now, there was the century-old question of determination of the position of a ship at sea. And one of the ways in which it could be solved was if you knew exactly the position at any time of the moon between the stars. Now, as it happens, with help of Newtonian mechanics and with help of the calculus, that problem could, to a very great degree, be solved. So here you see that the calculus really helped a very important practice by providing very accurate tables of the moon's position between the stars. So I'd like to say that the calculus in the 18th century shows the story of a very energetic application of a new mathematical tool to all sorts of problems, in some cases very successful, so that by this new mathematical tool, the study of nature and the control of natural processes was helped very much.
The program on this tape is part of the Open University course, AM 289, The History of Mathematics.